For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, so we are in James. We're going to finish up chapter 2 tonight. We're in easily the most controversial passage of the New Testament. So if you like controversy, you'll like this passage. And otherwise, maybe you'll just like the message because it's really sweet. In any event, we're studying James, and this whole series we've just called Practical Spirituality for the Real World, because that is what James is about. James is like, I'm just going to tell you the way it is, and I'm going to tell you in such a way that you remember it. So he uses a lot of exaggeration, a lot of comparisons. It's really an earthy kind of book in that way, which is why a lot of people like me really like it. There's just something concrete about what James says that is just so memorable. It sticks in your head. Tonight, he's going to talk about the partnership between faith and works. This is from chapter 2, verses 14 to 26. And we're just going to jump right in. He says, what use is it, my brothers and sisters, if someone says he has faith but has no works? Can that faith save him? So it's a kind of a lightweight chapter that we're dealing with here. What is he saying? He's going to contrast, really, throughout this whole thing. Real faith from pseudo faith. The real faith that God calls his people to versus the fake kind of faith and the traps of fake faith that people tend to find themselves in. And so that's what we're going to be talking about here. He's going to give a couple of examples of what he's not talking about, namely pseudo faith. And then he's going to give a couple examples of what real faith looks like. And so it's a partnership between what we believe and how we live. That's what he means by faith and works. And James, of course, as we've seen already, super practical in his focus. He's not really talking in abstract terms or in doctrinal terms necessarily, although, of course, there are doctrinal implications. But the idea that he's getting at right here is just in a practical way, you know, what does faith really look like in the real world? And so throughout the discussion, he'll use comparisons like useful faith versus useless faith. He'll talk about, hey, you tell me all about the things you believe. I'm going to show you what I believe by how I live. He's going to talk about dead faith, living faith. And so those are the comparisons that kind of run throughout this two-paragraph section of James. And it really kind of centers on this thing here where he says, if someone says he has faith but has no works. And it's the emphasis here on is if somebody says, and it has all about, you know, what you say. Now, this is the Memorial Tournament weekend. And I confess that in a former life, which is to say a long, 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 long time ago, I was a caddy. I was. And when I was 12 years old, I caddied in the NCAA finals at Ohio State's golf course, Scarlet Course. And at 12 years old, I was just like bug-eyed over this Stanford University golfer that I caddied for going into the final round. No, it wasn't Tiger Woods. And I said to one of my buddies, I said, my guy's going to win this whole thing. And because he was much older and wiser, namely he was 15, he goes, oh yeah, okay, Leffel, well, put your money where your mouth is. And that was the first time in my life I'd ever really thought about connecting my mouth with my actions. And I'm like, no. Because why? He had, in just a sentence, he had just revealed the poverty of my faith. Just like that. And James is doing that for us. Because there are plenty of people, it's easy to say, you know, yeah, I believe. In our culture, for instance, mid-90s percent people polled say that they believe in God. A very high percentage would identify themselves as Christian. Way over half, somewhere in the 70 plus percent, say that they are Christians. And yet, really, what does it mean? What is the content of their faith? And so you have this sense that, people have this sort of belief about themselves, but it just does, it doesn't have any bearing at all on what it really means, or it has no bearing on how they live their life. It's just sort of, I was born this way, this is who I am. And James is talking to people very much like that. And he says of the person who says that they believe, he asks the question, if that's all it is, if it's all talk and there's no walk, can that faith save him? And it's a rhetorical question. In other words, he's not really asking a question. He's making a statement. And the question that he is framed here demands the answer no. It can't save him. And he's going to go and he's going to show, give a couple of concrete illustrations of what inadequate faith is. And then he's going to go and he's going to give two really poignant examples of the kind of faith that God calls on each of us to display towards him. The two common mistakes that we need to understand just in the background of this whole discussion, the background really of the first century world, is that the whole faith in relation to works thing is a problem. First, in terms of what we call legalism. Here was this idea, and there were a lot of people parading around, some actually in the name of James himself, this very author, that Paul talks about in the book of Galatians, who basically are teaching this thing, this legalistic idea that God accepts us on the basis of faith, based upon the work of Christ on our behalf. He died for our sins. We received that payment for our sins. That clears the board. And now, ladies and gentlemen, you better be good. You better do the right thing. You need to show in your actions that you are righteous, and that if your works don't add up, well, then you're on the outs with God. You lose any kind of acceptance that God would give you on the basis of your personal merit. Now, I want to make it very clear, because we're going to talk about this in a little bit more detail in a few minutes because of the second paragraph in this passage, that James is not addressing that issue. That's not the issue that James is talking about. What James is describing is a different kind of faith versus behavior kind of issue, and that's what we call here dead orthodoxy. It's this idea of the person who says, but what they say is, as far as it goes, that there is no real working this thing out in terms of their behaviors. And such a person has sort of an impersonal belief, a theoretical belief, an abstract belief, a sort of a salvation by affiliation, I'm calling it here. These are the people like Jesus talked to, who said, you know, I'm okay with God because I'm a son of Abraham. You know, I'm okay with God because basically by birth I've been born into this group of people who are on God's good side. And so as long as I nominally maintain my identity as a Jew or whatever, then, you know, things are going to go well for me when I meet God face to face. And Jesus was appalled by this kind of behavior. He says, you know, God has the ability to take from these stones sons unto Abraham. Your birth, you know, your affiliations, none of those, your parents' faith, none of those things matter. Ultimately, those are just, you know, people can breathe all the right words. They can say all the right things. But that doesn't mean that they have the kind of faith that God is looking for. And Jesus talks about this in Matthew 25. He says there's going to come a strange kind of day for people, where some will come before me, you know, basically saying, I know the Apostles' Creed by heart. I know the Lord's Prayer, and I do all these things. And Jesus is going to say, well, yeah, here, but here's the problem. I don't know you. I don't know you. So maybe you've held on to the right kinds of beliefs, things that are actually true, but it made no connection in your heart and did not make a connection with me. And these are the very people that James is talking to. It's the nominal religious person of every culture, indeed of our own culture as well. And so that's what we got in mind here. And this is where James is going to then go off. He's going to make the point repeatedly, real faith is something that you can see in the real world. Real faith is something that you can see in the real world. And let's just break it down then. He goes on and gives us the first negative example. Verse 15, he says, if a brother or sister is without clothing and in need of daily food, and one of you says to him, go in peace, be warm and be filled, and yet you have not given them what is necessary for their body, well, what use is that? He says, even so, faith without works is dead, being by itself. Now, some of you may well say, you have faith and I have works. Well, show me your faith without your works, and I will show you my faith by my works. And so here it goes back down again into that very practical realm that James is so comfortable in. And he's saying, if you've got a faith that is just all talk and doesn't ever translate into action that's consistent with that, he says, that's useless. It's dead. And he says, the challenge is put out. He says, you know, you can say whatever you want. You can show me your faith by your eloquent speech or whatever. And I'm going to do something different, something that's a little more real. I'm going to show you my faith by my actions. And so here we have the first point, that works authenticate faith. It's that show me thing. It's I'm sure that James is probably from Missouri, the show me state. And that's what really matters. It's that practical thing that he's got going on. And what he's saying here is very important. He's not saying that our actions make us right with God. It's not like there's a merit system and that somehow if you rack up enough points that you're in with God. James is not saying that in any way. What he is saying is that works, things that we do, offer themselves as living proof of what's really in our heart. That's the issue. It's about being authentic in our faith. And so he has already used this language in these descriptions before in chapter 1 and also earlier in chapter 2 when he talks about the law of liberty, the royal law, this command of Christ that we be people who are actively loving other people, that's what he calls us to. That's important. That's at the center of living out the Christian life. And so now what he's doing here is he's taking that same conversation and he's just saying, look, if we want to talk about the nature of faith, we can never divorce it from the things that God has called us to exercise our faith in, namely these things that are appropriate extensions of where we are with God. We've been loved by God, and so we turn around and we love other people. And that is a kind of work, if we want to use that language, that really offers itself as proof that what we have going on in our hearts is a real and authentic thing. I like Paul puts it the same way, really, in Galatians chapter 5. He says circumcision means nothing. In other words, going under the Jewish law doesn't mean anything. He says, but faith working through love. Really, the Apostle Paul is saying exactly the same thing in Galatians that James is here in James chapter 2. That faith, when it's real, produces real change. And that's important, I think, for us to be mindful of. I like what Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5. He says, the love of Christ urges us on. I love that language. It's like if you have tasted the love of God, then it just produces in you this sense, this feeling that I want others to experience this really sweet thing that I have. And that's true, you know, if you've ever been to a really beautiful place. A couple of years ago, I was in Haiti on one of these trips. I was with took my daughter with me, and after we had spent a week doing some teaching with some of the national leadership there, we spent a day snorkeling in this little cove up the coast from Port-au-Prince. And I had never been in a coral reef before, and nor had my daughter. And it was just like being in another world. It was beautiful, and I'm sure many of you know what that experience is like. But it was funny. We got back on the boat, and we hit dry land, and we both remarked two things. One, how awesome it was, and two, how experiencing that together really made it real. You know, because when you experience beautiful things, profound things, there's this natural desire. You want to share that experience. And so when we have forgiveness that comes to us from God, when we're really aware of how far we are from Him and how far His mercy has moved towards us, it just produces us in us that desire to share it. It's a natural thing. That's what Jesus says in Luke 7, verse 47, when he says of this woman, he says, she who has been forgiven much loves much. It's just in the nature of things that when God delights us with his love and his mercy, if you understand that, if you get that, then like Paul, that urges you on. You just want others to be connected with that. It gives you an unusual change in what is important to you, in what you value, in how you see relationships, and how you begin to view your life. And that's a natural sort of consequence of God's involvement with you. This is what he's talking about here, and which is why it would be so bizarre for a person to have really met the living God and have been reconciled to him in this way, and for it to have absolutely no effect on their life. Well, here's the second deficient definition of faith that James gives to us. This is an interesting one. He says, you believe that God is one. You do well, but you share something in common with the demons who also believe but shudder. He says, are you willing to recognize, you foolish fellow, that faith without works is useless? Okay, so this is an odd argument. It's a fascinating argument. And he's saying, okay, belief. Well, is that really an adequate definition for faith? That you believe the right things, is that really what faith is? And clearly saying, no, that's not the case, and that there's a difference between knowing and believing. And where, okay, you've got these demonic personalities who've actually even been in the presence of God. They have impeccable theology. They know exactly what God is about. But they're not into God. They have not trusted God. And that's really the point here. Is that faith isn't just knowing what's true. Faith is about exercising personal trust. There's an act, in other words, of the will to personally entrust yourself to God. So knowing matters, but knowing is insufficient. There has to be also this other piece of it. How to illustrate this point? Well, let's go back 150 years to 1860 and meet a very famous tightrope wire act. Here's this guy. This is a true story. This guy is a Frenchman, and he came to the U.S., you know, because he wants to make himself rich and famous. And so he takes a cable from the Canadian side to the American side right above Rainbow Falls. And, you know, Niagara Falls. And he spends several days having set up this cable. He goes back and forth. Huge crowds are gathering around. This is an actual handbill from one of his things. He's up on stilts. And he walks across the wire with stilts. And then he shows up another day and he's got a wheelbarrow. And he takes the wheelbarrow across on the wire. This is amazing. Incredibly amazing. And after days of his dazzling the crowds, I mean, who could have done such a thing? He shows up with a harness attached to his back. And so he asks the question, how many of you think that I could actually put a man on this harness and walk him safely across the wire? And the crowds were like, yeah, I mean, heck, if you can do it with stilts, if you can do it with with all these other things, no problem. To which he then asks, okay, how about you? See the difference here between simply knowing and believing is very palpable. Of course, everyone knew that he could do this thing. But who's going to entrust their lives to him? And this is the question that God is asking you here tonight. He's not asking some abstract question of what do you think is true. He's asking, will you entrust the weight of your life, your future, your safety, your security, your all to me? Will you climb in that harness? You see, just as in the Niagara Falls, there is a chasm that separates God from humanity. It's even broader than the chasm that separates our little brother with us, Canada with America. It's a wide chasm. No one's going to be able to swim right across. The current is way too strong. No one like this balancing act dude is going to be able to walk across that wire. He's a very unique person. And so just that whole metaphor is out there before us. You know, Christ is calling us not to believe that he was, or even to believe important things like that he raised from the dead or that he paid for the sins of humanity. He's asking you to put your personal faith in him. He's asking, will you entrust me with your entire life, with your standing before God, for me to take you to a place over here where you are alienated from God into the presence of God? I have the ability to do that. But you have to choose. You've got to get in the harness. And that's where we go from the abstract to the personal. That's where we go from distance from God to relationship with God. This is what makes the cross of Christ count for you. Not just what you believe is true, but that you've trusted the work of Christ to be how you are going to find yourself before the living God. Okay, so that is a very significant piece. He's saying he's critiquing then the person who basically has the right doctrine and they're willing to yap and yap, but it doesn't manifest itself in their works. He's also talking about the person who has the right theology but is not trusting God in a personal way. And then in contrast to those things, he's going to give two specific examples in the positive vein. What should then our faith really look like? And this is where the fireworks begin. This is where the difficulty lies. We need to understand what he's saying here. Verse 21. Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered up Isaac his son on the altar? You see that faith was working with his works, and as a result of the works, faith was perfected. And the scripture was fulfilled, which says, and Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. And he was called the friend of God. And so you see that a man is justified by works and not by faith alone. Well, I have to tell you, the first time I read that, I'm like, wait a second. I've got the wrong translation. You know, this is not the Bible I thought existed. He's saying things here that just seem wrong. Abraham was justified by works. A man is justified by works and not by faith alone. Isn't that exactly running at cross purposes with the very definition of what the gospel is? The good news that God has moved toward us completely in Christ is simply asking us to get on that harness, to entrust ourselves with Him, not because of any works that we do, but just simply on the basis of this real trust in Him. And James seems to be saying something very different than that. Here's the contrast. James 2:24, you see that a man is justified by works and not by faith alone. Paul in Galatians 2 verse 26 says just the opposite. We're justified by faith in Christ and not by works of the law. So what is this? Is this just one of those things that your professor told you way back, you know, that the Bible's full of contradictions and this type of thing? You know, people say that all the time. You know, the Bible's full of contradictions. It's fun to be able to say, oh yeah, it's interesting. Which ones? And usually the conversation goes dead at that point because it's just what people have heard and have no idea what they're talking about. But it sounds good. Well, here, at least on the surface of it, looks like we've got a real contradiction on our hands. And it's of no small importance either, is it? It's at the very heart of what is God expecting from me? How will I stand before Him? On the one hand, it appears to say that it's all what God has done for me through Christ. And on the other, it seems to be that it's something about what I do for Him, the works that I perform. So let's just break this down a little bit. Let's ask this question, what does justified mean? And so it's important, as George Bernard Shaw once said, that Americans and British have been separated by a common language. That we use the same word and we mean often very different things by it. Sometimes the closer you are to somebody, the more of an opportunity there is to misunderstand what one another is saying. That is true, certainly, with this word justify. In the Greek, as in the English, the word justify has a lot of different meanings. It means in a legal context to exonerate someone, to declare that they're innocent, right? In accounting, we reckon the books by justifying the columns, right? If you're a carpenter, you know all about justifying because that's what it means to square angles and corners, things like that. If you're into an argument, philosophers will use justification as a synonym to validate. You know, well, okay, that conclusion is justified based upon the premises you've given. Things like that. So you see here, I'm trying to illustrate this fact that the word to justify in the Greek, as in the English, has a fairly broad range of meaning, which is determined primarily by the context in which the author is using it. You see what I'm saying? It's important. So in this context, note what James says in James 2:23. He cites Genesis 15:6, a very important verse. Genesis 15:6 in the Old Testament, it says that Abraham believed God and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. So in that sense, both Paul and James absolutely agree that there is no way that anyone stands before God on the basis of anything other than their belief that God then counts as right standing before Him. James himself has said earlier in this very same chapter, whoever keeps the whole law and yet stumbles in one point has been guilty of all. And so if we're looking at the law as a system of merits, as sort of a stair-step approach to working our way to God, James is our enemy. James is not on board with that at all. He's not saying that our standing before God is based upon our ability to garner his merit through the things that we do. He's made that impossible because he says if you just blow it in one of the 613 clauses of the law, you're guilty of the whole thing. It's not a basis for you to approach God with. And so inciting, as Paul does in Galatians 2 and also in Romans chapter 4, this important passage going all the way back to Abraham, where he just simply says that Abraham believed that the promises of God were true. That the promise of God to bring a son out of his own body, even though he was 90 years old, and his wife, no spring chicken. And Abraham said, okay, I believe that. And it's in the context of God's promise to Abraham. I will grant you a son. I will give you this land. I will bless your life and your and the nation that comes after you. And Abraham didn't do a thing. He did nothing. He believed that promise. And this passage teaches, and James citing it here is very important, it teaches that his standing with God was sealed by that belief. Just not because he was good, not because he had done the right thing, not because his faith was perfect, but just because he believed in this promise that God granted to him right standing with him. That's what righteousness is. And in that sense, Paul and James absolutely agree that justification comes not on the basis of our performance, but on the basis of our faith in the promises of God to us. What complicates things is what he says, you see that a man is justified by works and not by faith alone. You wonder, how could that possibly follow from what he's just said? Right? But James has a very different notion of justified going in this passage that Paul does. Notice he ties it. Abraham, our father, was justified by works. And then he later says in verse 24, he's justified by works. But what does he mean by justified by works? Well, he means the result of these works was a perfecting of Abraham's faith. That's what he means by justified. That the scriptures were fulfilled in his further act of obedience to God in this incident relating to his son Isaac. That is what James means when he says that what Abraham did, his works, justified him. And in that sense, he means justified as to vindicate, that the claim of being right before God is justified by the real world evidence of his life, the choices that he made. That's what he's talking about here. That's the context, the whole idea of putting your money where your mouth is, putting your faith to work. That's what the whole thing is about. So there's been a controversy about this whole faith versus works things rooted in this James passage that so often is just superficially understood. It doesn't take into consideration the context of what James' discussion is or the wide range of meaning about what is justification. What does that word even mean? See what I'm saying? It's an important point. This is the dividing line between a religious approach to God and grace. So it's very important that you understand this thing. In a positive way, what is James telling us about the life of faith evident in Abraham? Well, he's saying that his faith was perfected. We've seen that language already in James chapter 1, teleos, in relation to the trials that we endure that create a completion or perfection of our faith. That it is as we learn to walk with God on the basis of the promises that he has given to us, and we are willing to endure the difficulties of life that we face and continue to pursue him, that our faith becomes perfected. It becomes honed and sharpened and turns into something that is beautiful. We've been declared right before God. That's the legal sense of justification. And now through the course of our life, as we take those steps of trusting God, of taking action, of putting our money where our mouth is, then that our character, our inner life, our relationships, our values, all of these things begin to be shaped and molded into a reflection of what is God really all about? What is God's purpose for our lives? And so God's blessing for Abraham was accomplished as he acted on faith. You think about Abraham. He was given this great promise, leave your land, leave everything you know. I'm going to give you a great land. You're going to be a great nation. I'm going to bless you in all these ways. And there is Abraham trouncing around through Canaan with all of its messiness and still no answer, no son, no nothing. God comes to him a second time, you know, decades into it now, and saying, okay, I haven't forgotten the promise. And Abraham says, I believe. And God says, that's good enough. But there's going to be more years and more years between that promise and when it is fulfilled in the birth of Isaac. And what are Abraham and Sarah going to do at 90 during this period in which God said that your wife Sarah is going to have this child of promise through whom I'm going to build this great nation? Yes, they kept busy. And they trusted God in what must have seemed completely futile. But they did. And it was through their willingness to take action, to obey this promise, that God effected this incredible blessing for Abraham. It was on the basis of his willingness to act that this promise came into being, ended up in reality, was a part of his experience. And he had the son. And then he had the fulfillment of this great promise. And that's how it works. When we take action on the promises of God, they begin to take form and manifest themselves in our lives. It's an awesome thing. And Abraham's our example. He says here that the scripture was fulfilled, that Abraham's faith was justified in the sense that through his actions it fulfilled this very promise of God. That namely, that God's promise was fulfilled through Abraham's life of obedient faith. As he obeyed God, as they continued to sexually relate, him and Sarah, and that child finally comes, that God's promise to bless the whole earth through their bodies, through them, was fulfilled. And that also is an amazing thing, that not only is it through the actions of Abraham that God blesses his life, but also through that blessing blesses the entire world. Because that is a pivot point in the plan of God in the world. It's an amazing thing. There's a lot at stake. God takes our ability to make those choices to obey him, and he enters that into the equation of how am I working in the world. So we have this remarkable opportunity. This remarkable opportunity for our lives as we trust Christ in the things that he calls us to, like Abraham, to shape the way that eternity looks. And that's something I'm excited about. I think a lot of us here are excited about that opportunity. Let's just finish up the passage and we'll draw some application. He says in verse 25, in the same way, Rahab, the prostitute, also was justified by works, and she received the spies and sent them away by another way. And for just as the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without works is dead. I like that ending. But he points out to the example of Rahab. Now, Rahab was not, you know, the good guy that Abraham is portrayed as being, at least in part. Rahab was a prostitute. She lived in Jericho, this city that's going to be destroyed by the advancing Israeli army. And Rahab's one who has known all about the God who delivered the Hebrew people from their bondage to Egypt. And so when the spies came to check out Jericho, this Rahab woman, she said, "You, I want to protect you. I believe there is a God, and that God is with you." And here it is. You know, this woman, Rahab, believed in these promises that she wanted to be a part of. She wanted to be a part of God's people. And so she took this action of hiding the spies, and so that the rest of Jericho did not know what the plan of the invading Hebrews was going to be. And that she was saved by that. She was able to join in to God's people. She became an ancestor to David and indeed to the Lord Jesus Christ. That was a pretty good move on her part at that point. Okay, here's the point, though. Rahab and Abraham, both in their own very different ways, and maybe you relate to Abraham, maybe you relate to Rahab, maybe you relate somewhere in between. Both of them really lived out the drama, the dynamic, the adventure of faith. And I love their example. As different as these two people were, they both had a belief that led to very courageous actions. You think about this. After all of these decades, God granted to Abraham a son. Okay, so that he would be blessed, that he would have this nation, that God was good for his word. And now imagine that God is saying, you know, I'm glad that the confirmation of your faith has really come to pass. Here's the son. Now, here's what I want you to do. I want you to take that son who you love, your only son, and your only link to the promises that I have given to you, and I want you to take him up this mountain, and I want you to sacrifice him on an altar. Yikes. And Abraham had some calculation to do, didn't he? He takes his son. They journey 3 days to the south. Do you think that Abraham is just thinking about what kind of music he is going to download on his MP3 player or you know, whatever? Of course not. He is really thinking through. God has been working this incredible thing. He has given me the miracle of life. And now he's asking me to take the miracle of life and offer it up to him. And he did. He went up that hill and he takes that walk with his son. "Dad, where are we going?" "We're going to offer sacrifice, son." "Dad, where's the offering?" "God will provide." "Dad, this wood's pretty heavy." "It's okay." And Abraham, because he knew God, because he had been obedient to God in the past, he had seen God at work in this marvelous way, was willing to put his own son as a sacrifice to that very same God. And when the moment came, of course, the angel of the Lord comes to him and he says, "Stop. Now I know that you believe. Now I know." And he provides a substitute, a ram to offer up as sacrifice. But what's going on in the mind of this man, Abraham? He took God at his word. So did Rahab. Abraham, it says in Hebrews 11, verse 19, said in this regard to this event, that Abraham considered that God is able to raise people even from the dead. That even if his son had to die, he knew that he was the son of promise. God had said so. And so even if he would take his life away, Abraham knew that God would resuscitate him. Because why? Because he said he would. He's the God I've been obedient to and I've followed all this time. And so the results that were affected in Abraham's life were also results that furthered his purpose, both for Abraham and for others, and for you and me even today. There's something awesome about this story. In Hebrews 11, verse 9, in commenting on that, the author of Hebrews says that Isaac was received back by Abraham as a type. In other words, that he was kind of an illustration, a story that has a deeper meaning. That mountain that God said, I want you to go up and offer your son, just happens to be that mountain in Jerusalem upon which the temple is built. And it just also so happens to be the case that God too had an only son. And he sent that son into the world, and whereas he withheld the sacrifice of Isaac, he did not withhold the sacrifice of his own son. And it is through the obedience and the death of God's true son that the issue that separates all of humanity from God has been in one moment decisively removed. And that's what he means by Isaac as a type. The one that God said, I would never call upon you to do this thing, but I'm willing to do it myself. That contrast is the heart of God. And so how awesome it is then that Abraham is able, as he put his money where his mouth was, as he stood in there, And took God at his word and took action with that, that he is able to experience the incredible blessing of being this recipient of God's blessing and is able to be the vessel through which we stand before God. That ain't too shabby. That's okay. Here's the thought I've been having lately. Are you bored living the Christian life? I have the impression that many of us are bored. That what we are excited about, what we think about, what really animates us, what really gets our juice flowing, has a lot to do with what? Sleep? sports? How are those Bucks anyway? Work, accomplishment, our kids, lots of things, lots of good things too. But we just seem like maybe, you know, that idea that my own faith is alive, is challenging me, is rewarding to me, like my job is, like my family is, like my hobbies are, like my sports team might be. Why do we lack that same sort of passion for the things of God? And maybe just like the people James is writing to, that we're kind of sucked into this vapid, boring, habitual lifestyle, going through the motions, not with any real sense of expectation, not with any real sense that anything important is being accomplished. And I wonder if the examples of people like Abraham and Rahab aren't exactly what we need to be thinking about. I'm on my second lap of reading this book, simply called Radical. It's over there in the bookstore. It's pretty cheap, too. But it's written by a younger guy who I think is on to something really big, namely the Odyssey of the Life of Faith. It's refreshing. It's easy to read, and it's refreshing to go back to just the whole deal of what are we about and what is this great life that God calls us to. Let me ask you this. Is there risk involved in your faith? Is there risk involved? Is anything at stake in your belief? Faith is dangerous. Faith puts you at risk. Faith might get you hurt. Faith might make you poorer. Faith might get you rejected by people whose opinions mean way too much to you. And what you see in these examples of Abraham and Rahab is a dangerous faith, a risk where their life is on the line. Where's your life on the line in your faith? Where does it really matter? And how you trust Christ? That is an important question. And that's something that if we're not feeling that we're at risk, we're not feeling that we have dangerous decisions to make, decisions that might be painful to us on some level, then maybe we don't really understand this whole faith works dynamic that James is talking to us about. It's really an important thing. Where is that risk? Am I just compromising? Am I just walking through the motions? Where is the risk? I have been thinking a lot about a close relationship, a very close relationship that has caused me a significant amount of pain over the years. And I have found myself just, the way I deal with it is I steel my heart to it. And as a result, I'm just kind of frozen when it comes to how to relate to this person in a helpful way, in a real way. And I have found myself, I would rather be there than to move toward them persistently and graciously and honestly, because I know there's a very good chance I'm just going to be smacked down. And that I'm not sure I'm wanting that. But see, that's a no-risk position. There's no danger in that. And as a consequence, no effect in that either. We've all got things in our lives that we're calling, that God calls upon us. Put that in my hands. You step into that harness and you trust me with that thing. You let go of your control. You let go of your predictable life that insulates you from the pain of other people, of other things that might be challenging to you. The adventure of faith and the life that God calls us to is a life where there is a real goal to seek. Goal-centered. We're goal-centered in our careers. We're often very goal-centered with our kids. Sometimes we're way too goal-centered with our kids. But sometimes I feel like that same intensity, that same focus is just absent from my brothers and sisters about their own faith and what it's about. And what they think that God is calling on them to accomplish in this life. It's like there's no point to faith without some sort of a vision for my life. What's your vision for life? And then it reminded me earlier in the week, we're talking in a different context about some books that had influenced our view of family since our youngest is being shipped off to outside the house. And we'll be all alone. Now what? What's the vision for us? What's the purpose for us? What is the whole point of a family? It's to manifest the reality of God in our lives. Is that how you define your families, as an opportunity to manifest the reality of God in your lives through you to an ocean of people lost, confused, unable to put the desperate pieces of life together for themselves? There's a purpose for family. There's a purpose for our lives. And we need to discover that vision and move forward. Is there a catalytic partnership in living this life that the Lord calls us to? It's not just all about me and God. It's about we and God. It's about how we as His body connect with one another to accomplish the great things that God calls us to. This is where it's energizing. This is where it's fun. This is where 2 really dinged up people, 10 really dinged up people, a whole home church full of dinged up people come together like the island of misfit toys that we are, love each other, manifest the reality of God's grace, and we see people change. Beautiful. It's awesome. Well, those are just some thoughts. But I do think that James is bringing us into something that is really good. Faith without works is dead. It's lifeless. It doesn't accomplish anything. Let's put our money where our mouth is. Let's live large. Let's do the things that God calls us to do.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.